pleasant to have missed it for more reasons than one. Also, it leaves me a little bit at a loss to know exactly how to handle this last session, because I haven't participated or contributed to the earlier ones. My preparation for this seminar included a review of all the materials that John had been sending out to all of you, including the pre-session scenarios, and also the reports that you were turning out from your various groups, and the attempt to synthesize these reports as they went along. I've gone over this, and the conclusion I come to is that you've been involved in a rather extended exercise, which I think has been stimulating to you, frustrating, and certainly exhausting. And I'm a little bit hesitant to be critical of the outcome. But because I am an Alaskan, and because I'm very much concerned, as you all are, with the future of Alaska, I think I'll set aside my good manners and be critical. I find in the reports that they are written on two levels. In part, I think this reflects your reaction to the seminar as they have been conducted. This is nobody's fault except the pressures and so on. But at one level, you seem to be concerned to somehow translate the visions of post-industrial society and so on that you've been exposed to at the lectures into something in your report. At the other hand, you are revealing something of the torment and agony of the advertising man who's trying to think up new words to describe the same product that his client is peddling. Many of your specifics really fall into this category. Their attempts to find new ways of saying the same thing. When they're translated, it comes up with doing not so many different things as doing more of the same sort of thing. I know this is not what you intend in the reports, and the reports are not in finally, but to date, looking at the way the reports have come out, there's a vast middle part of the report, the substance of the report, that still really hasn't fully emerged. As I say, I'm being a little bit unfair in doing this because I haven't contributed anything yet, but I felt I should start off on this note. And believe me, I'm not trying to belittle anything that anyone has done. But as we go into the final session, I think we should look at the seminar, look at what we've done so far, and start asking some of these rather basic questions before the thing finally winds up. As I say, I've only looked at the record as it has been duplicated. I know very well, knowing most of you for a good many years, that there's been a lot more going on. And John Havelock, I think very aptly put it, that there is a hidden agenda to the Brookings seminars. I'm sure there is. I have great faith that there is. I'm looking forward to that hidden agenda surfacing sometime before too long. In trying to understand why it has come out this way so far, I think in part the staff and its earnest desire to make the thing work has perhaps been a little bit overzealous in not simply making a program, but in attempting to program the participants. Again, this is not their intent, but I think this is the way it's turning out. As we go into the final days of this session, I'd like to come back to some rather basic questions and ask them and answer them with you, if I might, to see if we can't bring this thing to the sort of conclusion I think all of us intended, including the Brookings staff, including certainly the Legislative Council. First of all, I think I'll just dwell on three basic questions. First is the question of, I think most of you must have asked, is why on earth you personally were selected to come to this conference, or these seminars, rather. When we look at the roster, we see a rather wide spectrum of professions, businesses, occupations, and we also see a range of regional distribution of the attendants and participants. But one thing we all have in common is that all of us have been in Alaska for varying periods of times, certainly significant periods of time. We have had a chance to observe the development of the state of Alaska to date, in varying degrees of detail, and we've participated in this in some way, either directly or indirectly. So in effect, the reason we are all here is that we, and not the outside lecturers in the seminar, nor the Brookings Institution, are the experts. And this is exactly what I think John Osmond and the Brookings Institution people intended. If I may borrow some of the rather frightening things that Gordon talked about this morning, this is a rather extended version of the Delphi technique applied to this particular operation. I think it's significant that each of you, each of the groups that you're members of, have been given Greek letters as their designation. There may be something more to this than meets the eye. The Delphi technique, of course, I'm not going to dwell upon it because it's already been dwelt upon, is one in which there is supposed to be some feedback from experts on a particular subject. You and I are experts, the only experts for that matter, on the subject of Alaska development. A second basic question I'd like to come to is what we're supposed to accomplish here, and I'm sure each of you have asked this question, particularly as the time for close draws closer. I know because of the nature of their operations, Brookings Institution and the University of Alaska would like to have some sort of report turned out, concrete evidence that something has happened here. And to this end, I think they are applying what I mentioned earlier, and Gordon has dwelt upon, the scenario approach to the future, the immediate future. John has done, I think, with considerable skill, writing a scenario of what is going to happen at these conferences, in the schedule of the unfolding of the seminars. And I understand from the participants that, in fact, the scenario has been played out. But what is lacking in the scenario, and what is lacking in the results of this process, is, of course, some substance that we need. And this, I think, we are going to turn our attention to in the last couple of days. Now, I'm not suggesting that you rise up as individuals and throw off this attempt to program you. I mean, I don't think it's quite that bad. I'm overstating for this purpose. But I think that you should consider what really is important in this process. We do have to turn out a report, and we should turn out the best report possible. But my feeling, having been through similar experiences before, is that the report is always going to be a disappointment. It's going to be some variation of the classic definition of a camel being a horse designed by a committee. What is important in this is the experience itself, attempting to turn out a report. The fact that we have been brought together, that a certain discipline or framework has been imposed upon us in an attempt to get us to focus on certain things that we have considered in our own individual ways. And in this process, John Havelock's hidden agenda is shaping up. And I think this is the really important thing of this conference. So if the report comes out and you're not particularly happy with it, don't worry. You've been part of an experience that I am convinced will have tremendous impact later and in the longer run future. Just before I was to come up here, one of the participants asked me, and this is a footnote, but it has some relevance, if I had copies of the reports of the Canadian Transportation Committee I've been serving on unofficially for a number of years. And I think this is a very good example of the differences between the way we sometimes do things and the Canadians. This committee has no particular official standing. It doesn't appear in any organization chart. Its membership has varied over the years. I have the privilege of being the only American member. My expenses have been paid by passing the hat among the firms and agencies represented by the other members. The membership consists of first vice presidents of all the principal transportation companies in Canada, the two railroads, the two airlines, communications, the Bell Telephone Company, a number of the mining companies who are doing development work in the north. The purpose of the committee is to somehow introduce a note of rationality into the elaboration of a transportation network in the Canadian Arctic and North. No reports are coming out, as I say, and this is one of the strengths of this particular operation, because individual members of the committee, if a report came out, would feel compelled to state the position of their particular professional bias. Roads are the answers, railroads are the answers, airlines are the answers, whatever. Because there isn't even a secretary taking notes, they can all talk as experts on transportation, and a consensus comes out, which each of us has taken notes personally on, which we then take back, and of course I've never had a chance to apply this except to writing some rather nasty articles about transportation in Alaska. Each of us then applies this to the decision process in his own individual firm. And as a result of this, a lot of duplication, a lot of false starts, a lot of mistakes, I believe, have been avoided in the process. It's a going concern. I haven't been to a meeting recently. Perhaps it isn't a going concern any longer, but until recently it was, certainly. But as I say, there was no emphasis upon agenda, reports, and such. The deliberations were translated immediately into action. And this, members of this seminar who are members of the legislature, are going to be faced with that in the next month. You're going to have to somehow translate some of the things that you may have discovered, some of the things you may have developed, some new concepts and viewpoints, into some sort of laundry list of legislation, and do it rather quickly. I think most of you hoped that the laundry list might come out of this conference. Maybe it will. I'm sorry, I keep calling this a conference. It looks like a conference, but it isn't, I know. But I think the important thing is that somehow what has been started here be kept alive. It might even be advisable for the Legislative Council, and I think this is, of course, suggesting cruel and unusual punishment for all of you, consider reconvening the seminars sometime next year to see what has happened and see what should happen again, to take some second looks at this. My whole point in this particular, raising this particular point, is to put you at ease about any criticisms I may have made at the opening about the reports. My final basic question gets down to considering the nature and the meaning of the event that brought the Legislative Council to undertake such an exercise. Again, I find that the record, and I'm distinguishing very carefully between the record and what actually has been going on here, does not reflect any clear understanding of the significance of this event. And I do know that most of you have some understanding of this, but somehow this has not come into the record yet. I use the term event rather than development, and this was done deliberately, and that gets me to being a professor. I always start out by defining terms. This takes up time. It also causes the students to take out their notebooks because I might ask them questions about this. But it also, I think, gives us a chance to think about what it is we should be doing. Now, when a professor defines terms, he can be very arbitrary because he's the final authority on this, and I'm going to be rather arbitrary. I'm going to make a distinction between events and developments here. And I think there is a value and a purpose in doing this. The dedication of the petrochemical plant on the Kenai last June, the September oil lease sales, these were events, not developments. I think they're generally referred to as developments, but in my context, they are not. The development, the petroleum development, is a process. It extends back many more years than most of us realize, and it is going into the future, at least until the opening of the next century in Alaska. Oil was not discovered on the Kenai Peninsula in 1957 or at Prudhoe Bay in 1968. The Indians and Eskimos knew about the presence of oil, although they may have referred to it as something else, long before that, and the first white men certainly knew about it. There's a little tiny footnote in one of the tables in the Institute's brochure on the review of the economy in 1968, which indicates that between 1901 and 1932, the Cotilla oil field produced a total of 150,000 barrels of crude oil. I remember before we came to Alaska, one of my relatives-in-laws was out in the Aleutians, desperately trying to find a wedding present sent to us, one of these Alaska souvenir tablecloths. It was something that was printed in the 1930s, and there was an oil gusher down on the Gulf, and another oil gusher up in the Arctic. The little oil well at Katella also had a refinery. So the Kenai refinery was not the first refinery built in Alaska either. Admittedly, the amount of output was very small and the range of products very limited. But given the technology of the time, it could have been much more and much more varied if somebody wanted to do it. In other words, the petroleum was there, we knew it was there, it was just simply a matter of the time. The point in the development process at which it was appropriate for an event to take place. The event that took place was the striking of oil in the Kenai and at Prudhoe Bay and everything else that went in between those two events. And so we are concerned here with the impact of an event, the September oil lease sales, upon another development process. And that development process is not petroleum development, it's Alaska development. And this gets us into another range of definitions. When you're defining development in terms of a region, a state, well, then we pull together a lot of strands. Development becomes not so much a process as a statement of objectives. We can generalize this into economic and social development. Generally, economic development has as its objective the increasing of the material levels of income, employment, and so on. One shorthand used by economists in determining the level of development comparatively is per capita income. And one objective by many planners who are trying to foster development is to raise per capita income. There are other objectives, of course, on the economic side that get into and have impacts upon social development, and that is how much of this development is translated into jobs and how broadly is the income spread among the population. Dick has touched a little bit upon this in stating some of the objectives of fiscal and finance policy. In terms of social development, the objectives are various versions and statements of bettering the human condition. Now, economic development, if it does provide jobs, if it does provide for a spread of income among the population, does promote social development, but not necessarily so. I'm not going to dwell upon this, but I think we can all bring up examples from the past in which economic development did the reverse. The Industrial Revolution, so-called, in Britain, for example, meant that people were exploited and made miserable, their lives shortened and made brutish, in order to increase the gross national product. My grandparents on my mother's side still told the stories of the Highland clearances in which their parents and grandparents were torn from their land and deposited in slums in Glasgow and Edinburgh, and eventually their children came to this world to find a new life. This was done, according to my grandfather, without any legal backing and certainly any moral backing on the part of the people who became the landowners. Something of the sort, I think, might be reflected here. So economic development doesn't necessarily result in social development. Social development has, assure that it does, and ensure that we do accomplish this, we have to have clear statements of our objectives, what we want to accomplish, what we want to see happen. And then we can take the process of economic development, we can take the individual events, and then try, through whatever means at our disposal, to either change, to alter, or to stop these developments and events in accordance with how this action reflects upon the objectives we would like to see happen for all of us. As I was thinking about this seminar, preparing for it, it occurred to me that it was exactly 10 years ago this month that I completed the manuscript for my book, The Future of Alaska. I held up further release of the book until the 1960 census reports were in, at least the preliminary reports in April, May, and June. And then, of course, the publishing and review process took a little bit further. So it was over a year before the book actually appeared. But the writing of the book was accomplished 10 years ago, almost to this month. I'm introduced this personal note because, in a sense, what is happening here is an extension of what I was trying to do at that time. At that time, an event had taken place, the granting of statehood. Again, this was not a political or social development, it was simply an event. It was part of a process, a development process that extended back to the first attempts of the settlers at Sitka, possibly, to organize some form of government. And it embraces, at least in my interpretation, the present attempts of the native people to become more effectively a part of this whole process. And it will go on as long as there is a state of Alaska. The importance of the event, I was fearful, the meaning of the event might be lost. I was concerned because prior to that event, I had taken part in various capacities in a crusade. Crusades are generally religious affairs in which certain statements of faith, belief, are put forward dogmatically in order to promote the objectives of the crusade. And these are not questioned. And I felt now that we had achieved statehood, it would be wise to stop and question what it really meant. To me, statehood was simply a tool that had been put into our hands. It was a tool we could use or we could not use if, as we saw fit. What it meant was that there had been a transfer of a degree of sovereignty into our own hands, that we no longer had to depend upon other people to allow us to do things. There was a whole range of things we now could do for ourselves. Eventually, we would have control over resources and land. The event set up a mechanism by which this could be accomplished. The objectives, the event had an impact upon the objectives of economic development. Up to that point, economic development had been primarily for national and for special outside non-resident interests. Now economic development could be made to promote other objectives, namely the development of an American society in Alaska. This was the meaning to me of the event. Now, how do you translate that into fact, into part of the process? In my book, I started out by examining where we were at that point, how we got there. This is not due to any interest in history per se, but it was because I felt that we carry into the present and into the future a lot of opinions, views, myths, if you will, which condition and determine our behavior. And we should always ask ourselves, is the conventional wisdom relevant to today? What we should do is understand how we got here, how some of these things got into use, when they might have had some validity and some relevance, and ask whether they still do. If not, discard them and try to find and develop substitutes. Also, I was concerned at looking at the future not as something that happens the day after tomorrow, but something that has been happening in the past, and that the future is determined to a large extent by this continuing process. As I looked into the future at that time, if any of you looked at these chapters, you'll notice that I'm not too specific about the form of the future. I merely presented as certain alternatives that may come about, as certain avenues that seem to be opening up that we might choose to follow or to push toward. The future was something that we had some control over, but not entirely all the control that we might imagine we had over it. And so it became a matter of adapting ourselves and attempting to adapt the things that happened to us and around us to serve what we had formulated as what we wanted to happen, what objectives we wanted to arrive at. And so I moved from a meaning of the future to a discussion of the meaning of statehood to the final part of my book, which was what I considered to be the areas in which we had to do some work to learn to manage our own affairs and to manage our future. Now, the number of topics I selected there, generalized, I thought at the time, were the key subjects, or the key areas in which we should formulate our individual policy. This seminar has got to do something of the same sort of thing. It's got to determine where we have advanced in the last 10 years, what this has meant, what we want to do with what time lies ahead, have some look at the avenues that are now opening up for us, make some decisions as to which we might follow, and so on. So what we've got to do here is to re-examine the future as a continuing process, to really get to the meat of the meaning of the event that occurred back in September, and then set forth what it is we have to do to learn how to be rich, which to me, I think, is one of the things we've got to learn at this point. Now, I'm going to take you through a few steps right now, and like both Paul and Dick, I hope tomorrow to be a little more specific, but this is sort of a preconditioning session you're going through now, if you hadn't guessed. And then tomorrow, I hope that we can tie things down a bit. What has happened since I wrote my book in the 1960s, to the 1960s? We are now in a position where we're going to look at the 1970s. Looking at the 1960s, at that time looking ahead 10 years, there were three major things, developments I saw taking place in the Alaska economy and in the Alaska polity. One was the shift from a military-based economy to a natural resource economy. A second, which I at that time I thought was going to be a much longer range trend and shift, was the shift from a domestic-oriented to an internationally-oriented economy. And the third was a matter which I couldn't at that time predict the form of its emergence, but it was the broader recognition that we were not one Alaska, but two Alaskas, Native Alaska and non-Native Alaska, and that somehow this would be brought to our awareness, all of us, not just a few of us, and that somehow we would be forced to face up to this and learn how to alleviate the feelings that were aroused by this and to bring the two Alaskas into some sort of a viable union. Now, these were the three developments I was anticipating during the 1960s. The record, as I say, has been one that things have happened a lot faster than I ever anticipated they would happen. I'm going to give you just a few figures, just to remind you that I'm an economist, actually. The New York Times reported me as a sociologist at the last conference. Not that I was insulted by this, by the way, just that I seem to talk more as a sociologist than an economist, but to get back to figures. I've compiled the average annual gross revenue or income, I shouldn't use the term revenue, that fits into state, income developed by certain major economic activities in Alaska. Let's take the 5 years immediately preceding the construction of the first pulp mill in Southeast Alaska, the period 1951 to 1955. The average annual expenditures of the Department of Defense each year came to $412,900,000. The total value of all natural resource products annually for that same period was only $122.4 million. Of this, fisheries accounted for $83 million. There was no petroleum and natural gas. Other minerals, mostly sand and gravel, accounted for $23.9 million. Forest products, $8.3 million. Furs, including the Pribilof Island furs, $4.7 million. And commercial agricultural products, $2.5 million. The last five-year period for which I have data, 1964 through 1968, the average annual defense expenditures in Alaska, and this included considerable extra expenses for reconstruction after the 1964 earthquake, came to $324.7 million. The total value of natural resource products was $365.8 million, more than the Department of Defense spent, as compared with the comparison 5 years before the first pulp mill went into operation. Fisheries value for that period had increased substantially due to a revival of salmon to a certain extent, but mostly due to the broadening of the base of the fisheries industries to include crab and other species. The average annual value of fisheries products wholesale prepared for market was $165.3 million. Petroleum and natural gas, the average annual value was $80.9 million. Other minerals, $37.1 million. Forest products, $72.2 million. Furs, $5.8 million. And commercial agricultural products, $4.5 million. Now, this last figure only tells part of the story. The comparison with the five-year period, 1951 to 54, shows a tremendous advance. But if you look at this last five-year period year by year, and to do this, I refer you again to the tables in our institute's 1968 look at the Alaska economy, you will see that there's a very dramatic year-by-year acceleration in certain of the natural resource categories, this taking the year 1968 alone. Fisheries products for that year came to a value of $217.5 million. Petroleum and natural gas, $187.9 million. Other minerals, $30.7 million. Forest products, $92 million. Furs, $6 million. Commercial agricultural products, $5.3 million. As we look into the future, the immediate future, things that are already there happening this year, scheduled for next year and the year after, will accelerate this trend even further. I will come back to some of these a little bit later. But all you have to do is to think of some of the events that have occurred just this year to see what I mean by this. The shift of Alaska from a military economy to a natural resource economy has been accomplished in a much shorter time than I envisaged 10 years ago, and the trend is that it will go much further than I anticipated at that time. I mentioned the other shift being the shift to an international economy, or internationally oriented economy, I should say. Again, looking at some figures. For the period 1931 to 1940, the last decade before World War II was really upon us, Alaska's foreign trade consisted of $335,000 value of imports and $378,000 of exports. When you examine these data more carefully, you will find that most of the exports and imports are merely value of products passing through Alaska en route into northern Canada, into Yukon Territory, and so on. So for all practical purposes, we had no foreign trade worth mentioning. Immediately after the war, at least pretty close to the after the war, 1948 to 1953, the value of foreign imports had risen to $1,417,000, exports $2,830,000. For the period 1964 to 1967, the value of imports had risen to $9,129,000, and the value of exports to $40,858,000. Now, if we examine the nature of this makeup of our foreign trade, we find that virtually all of it is represented by Japanese goods imported and wood products and fisheries products exported to Japan from Alaska. I said that the process has happened a lot faster than I expected. I was thinking in terms of an internationally oriented Alaska emerging in the decade of the 70s and 80s. But as you can see, it has emerged already. The long-run future I was looking at has been here. And again, looking at the events of the last year or two, we can see that this trend is one that is expanding and going to go on. The U.S. plywood champion mill last year signed a contract with Japanese firms to provide them annually with $40 million worth of pulp and lumber for a 15-year period. That contract alone, when it is implemented, will double the present value of exports, foreign exports, from Alaska. This summer you had a dedication of an ammonia and urea plant at Kenai. Most of this output is going to Japan. The last 2 months you've had the first two round trips of a special tanker carrying liquefied natural gas to Tokyo. And this tanker will be joined by a sister ship next year. Again, the value of this, for which I don't have a figure written down here, will greatly increase the value of our exports. All of these are developments that are financed in large part by Japanese capital and in which the market is Japan. Those of you who have read the Forbes magazine or the reprint of most of it in the Anchorage News will remember that there was one little box in which the degree to which Japan has already invested in Alaska is laid out in terms of names of companies and their interrelationships. I think this is required reading for all Alaskans. What does this mean to us in our desire to develop our state? You'll notice that I haven't talked about the North Slope yet, and I'm saving that because I feel that this is something that shifts to a different scale. What this means, of course, is that first of all, some of the things I had raised, a matter of money, a matter of determining the public interest, a matter of determining our direction or objectives, have got to be carefully re-examined. Dick mentioned a section in my book which I was dealing with the matter of highway finances. I was concerned then with a state that was a pauper state. We were having difficulty making ends meet. I think many of you will recollect, and if you don't recollect, you can look at the statistics, that immediately after statehood, we were suffering a general recession, economic recession. Fortunately, it didn't last too long, but it was a fairly serious one. And it passed a gloom over the entire period immediately after the granting of statehood. We were faced with the task of trying to put our house in order, trying to make the state a paying proposition before the transitional funds ran out. And as it happened, the funds ran out before we were ready. When the Alaska earthquake came along, we had a slight reprieve. But at that time, the matter of money was one of our top priorities. It was a very immediate thing. We might have to compromise some of our longer range objectives in the interest of staying alive financially. But more importantly, I felt that every expenditure we made as a state had to be evaluated in terms of whether or not it contributed to further development of the state. And this is the reason I dwelt upon highways at that time. Because highways, as they were being built, were not being developed as tools for development. Although, as Dick reminds you, this was the rhetoric used in justifying the expenditures. It was used in providing amenities for urban dwellers. Now, if I were writing the book, I wouldn't say this, because now we have development happening. It's development that is happening in spite of us in many cases. Our problem is one of adapting to the development. We are now in a position to consider amenities more than developmental expenditures. And so, possibly, what I said then doesn't necessarily apply to the present. The same is true on other fiscal matters, but I'm not going to go into that because this encroaches a little bit on Dick's field. I think the matter of public interest is one that is going to be of prime concern to us in the future that is emerging and the future that is now with us. My time as an Alaskan goes back long enough that a good deal of it was spent during our period as a territory. And I can remember our territorial legislature, which because of the inadequate system of representation, because of all the inadequacies of the mechanism itself, was ideally suited to manipulation by lobby groups representing at that time the canned salmon industry and the mining industries. And I think many of you will recall that period. Some of you may have been on the other side the time I was serving as economic advisor to Governor Greening. But it was very enlightening to see how the legislative process could be taken over and manipulated by what we considered at that time rather powerful economic interests. These economic interests, of course, are peanuts compared with the economic interests we now have in our state. I'm not saying that the new economic interests are evil, are out to do us in. I don't believe that for one moment. But what I am saying is that their objectives of development are narrower than ours. They are in business to get out resources as economically, as efficiently as possible. And they will do so. If this means that it will be necessary to exert some influence, some pressure upon the tax structure, I wouldn't be surprised if they exert some pressure upon our legislators to consider certain forms of taxes over others or not consider any taxes. I think we were introduced, or rather had the rather sorry spectacle down at Juneau. Unfortunately, I was out of the state at the time, maybe fortunately, in which a hearing was held on the tax incentive for the construction of the paper mill in the area. From what I have heard, only one local resident had the nerve, the courage, the naivete, whatever term you wish to ask, to get up and ask the representatives of the company, do you really need this incentive? The decision to build the plant had been made some time ago. Considerable commitment had been made in the form of investment in development and so on. But legislation existed on the books, and the company is not to be blamed for at least trying to get the tax incentives which were available, and they did. We've got to consider this more carefully in the future. We don't have to be beggars any longer. We have to, though, guard, as I say, the public interest. And this is a very tricky term to define. I'm not going to attempt it here. I attempted that in my book. And if any of you have read it, I think you may find either areas in which you agree or disagree with me. And I'd be glad to talk about that some other time. But this becomes a very top priority to us. The public interest is not necessarily the interest of the oil companies. It's not necessarily the interest of the Japanese investors. It may be the areas in which they overlap. But we've got to be very careful. We've got to understand what their motivations are, what their objectives are. These firms are very susceptible to public pressures. They have a very sensitively developed public relations sense. And if there are things that they plan to do over which there is considerable protest, I am confident that they will modify and adjust their plan of action. If not, they'll go ahead, as they say, in the most efficient economic way from their standpoint. So what we are going to be faced with now that we have development on this scale is being on guard to see that the public interest is not harmed or neglected or overlooked in the things that are taking place. Now, there's another matter which I'll just touch on very briefly, not because it doesn't deserve more time, but because the time is running out. I will have a chance to rebuttal on this a little bit later. And that's the matter of the so-called native land claims. I say so-called native land claims because the terms native and land are imposed upon this process of development by the legal framework in which it has emerged. Really, what is concerned here is something that parallels, or rather is an extension of the whole process of which statehood was one phase. And that is the increased participation of Alaskans in the processes that affect their future and their well-being. The fact that land is being used is something that I would not have predicted 10 years ago. The fact that an organization, a political organization, such as the Alaska Federation of Natives might arise, I would not have predicted. I knew Alaskan Natives were going to become more politically active, but the model I would expect at that time, 10 years ago, would be the model that was followed in 1912 by the Tlingit and Haida when they set up the Brotherhood and Sisterhood. This was an organization that understood the two-party system in our political structure and learned how to operate with, live with, and use that system. The Alaska Federation of Natives uses a more direct political approach. And in order to do this, they had to have certain weapons, if you will, certain tools to bring their particular plight to the attention of the rest of Alaska. The land claims, I think, were a very convenient and a very appropriate tool to do this. Because land is not just a legal thing, it has all sorts of emotional connotations. I mentioned earlier some of my ancestors being torn up from their land and thrown into ghettos and then having to migrate. When I speak about the natives and my own concern about their concern about land, I don't speak from any sense of guilt for past mistreatment by Americans of the native peoples. My people weren't here yet. I speak as a person who has had certain forebearers who spoke to me when I was a child of what it meant to be a dispossessed people in your own land. And these are the things that are really underlying the whole land issue. As I say, it has to be played out in legalistic terms because that's the way the game is laid out. But when we consider this, I'm not so much concerned about the merits of one proposal as against another. I'm concerned that the thing be played out in such a way that we recognize that this is simply one event. The process of which it is part will go on. There will not be a settlement of the native problems, the native issues. There will be a disposal of land and monies, or possibly royalties. But this will be merely a means of transferring, reallocating some of the wealth, of giving some of the Alaskan people a toehold on preserving their identity as human beings. Whether they actually own Alaska or only a piece of it. The fact that there has been recognition that this is their land will mean a great deal to the way they approach the future. And it is up to us as non-natives to recognize this as being the really basic thing underlying this whole movement. The next step, what happens next? This is anybody's guess. But what happens next depends upon the attitudes, the way we approach dealing with this specific thing. This will have a great bearing on what happens next. As I said at the beginning, I intended this to be a preconditioning session. I haven't gotten too specific. Tomorrow afternoon, I hope to get more specific. I may not come up with the laundry list some of you legislators might wish, but I hope that I will do something to bring it a little bit closer to realization. Thank you.